This is Ocean Robbins, and I am so excited to welcome you to the Food Revolution Summit. You're one of 100,000 people who are participating in this summit and who are taking a stand for healthy, sustainable, humane, and conscious food. Today, our summit begins with an incredible team of speakers. Our topic today is Feast and Thrive, Your Keys to Vibrant Health. In a few moments, you'll hear us on the line with Dr. Mark Hyman. At the top of the next hour, you'll hear from Dr. Dean Ornish. And an hour after that, you'll hear from Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Each of these food luminaries will be interviewed via teleconference by my dad and colleague, best-selling author John Robbins. And after each interview, you'll hear pre-recorded bonus presentations and music until the top of the next hour, which is when the next interview starts. Here we go.
Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Mark Hyman. Dr. Mark Hyman is a family physician, an 8-time number one New York Times best-selling author, including the recently released bestseller, The Blood Sugar Solution 10-Day Detox Diet. Activate your body's natural ability to burn fat and lose weight fast. He's also founder and medical director of the Ultra Wellness Center and chairman of the Institute for Functional Medicine. Mark serves as medical editor for the Huffington Post and on the medical advisory board of the Dr. Oz Show. In 2011, working with Pastor Rick Warren, Mark helped the congregation of Saddleback Church to collectively lose more than 250,000 pounds. His blood sugar solution program has changed the lives of millions of people, and we're thrilled to have him with us now. So now, Mark, my dad and I are so glad to have this time with you, and for the interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad, John Robbins.
Thank you, Ocean, and thank you, Mark, for being with us once again. It's always a pleasure and a privilege to talk with you.
Well, I'm excited to be here, John. You're one of my heroes and inspirations, so I feel like I'm talking to one of the leading voices in this whole movement who was calling the shots before anybody was brave enough to. So that, I think, it's exciting to be here talking about these things with you.
Well, thank you. I'm honored that you would say that. I want to start with some numbers. In 1950, people in the United States, we spent 22% of our disposable personal income on food and 5% on health care.
Yep.
Now, we spend 9% of our disposable personal income on food and 18% on health care. So the percentage we spend on food is less than half of it was then. But the percentage we spend on what we call health care, but which really probably more accurately would be called disease management, has nearly quadrupled. I'm reminded of an ancient Ayurvedic proverb, when diet is wrong, medicine is of no use. When diet is correct, medicine is of no need.
This is so true.
What's going on here?
We've got it backwards and upside down. And when you understand that food is medicine, that food is information, not just calories, when you change the quality of the food we eat, which we've done in a disastrous way for the worse over the last 50 years, it leads to tremendous amounts of disease. That's why we've shifted 22% from food to 5% of healthcare in the last 50 years to now 9% of our money on food and 18% of healthcare. So we're getting poor quality food that's cheaper, but we're spending a lot more on healthcare. And the problem is that food is both at the same time the cause of this obesity, chronic disease epidemic, and it's also the solution, because using the right foods, food that's high quality, that's whole foods, it's plant-based foods. I worked with Rick Warren, as you mentioned in the intro, and we got his church to 15,000 people, who's 250,000 pounds in a year. And I got up on the stage and I was promoting the book we wrote called The Daniel Plan, which is really a faith-based wellness program and that we do together in community. And I said, you know, it's very simple. You leave the food that man made and you eat the food that God made. It's really simple. And if you just kind of remember that principle, it's very easy to choose because, you know, gee, an apple, that was made by whatever, if you believe in God or not, if you made by nature. If you eat, you know, some processed apple-like strips that are like those little fruit rolls, like that's a weird food. Like that doesn't grow on a tree. You know, so it's really pretty simple when you dumb it down and you realize that the food we're eating today is not only higher in processed ingredients and sugar and flour, but it's altered through hybridization of plants. It's altered through genetic modification of organisms. It's altered through the addition of chemicals and additives in amounts we've never seen before. And all that is driving this chronic disease epidemic.
I know you're featured in a new film called Fed Up that is narrated and I think co-produced by Katie Couric. And it's coming out real soon. And in that film, the statement is made that we now have 600,000 food items in America, and 80% of them have added sugar. I don't know how many of those 600,000 were made by God, to use the term you were using a minute ago.
Probably none, John, none, zero.
Can you tell us about Fed Up, the film?
Well, I got involved with this project because I'm a friend of Lori David's, and I was the medical contributor to the Katie Couric show. And they wanted to create an inconvenient truth for obesity, childhood obesity in particular, and the food industry. And they really did not hold back in any way in this movie. And it's frightening when you see how they paint the picture of what's happening. And they do it in a number of ways. One, through the lens of children. So they gave a whole bunch of kids cameras and videos that they could tell their own story. And then they documented their struggles with obesity. And you see these, you know, one 15-year-old who's 400 and something pounds needing a gastric bypass. You see massively overweight teenagers craving and being addicted, literally addicted to sugar and processed foods. You see an 11-year-old who's 200 and something pounds who's eating all the wrong things and exercising all the time and not able to lose the weight. And it really is powerful to see it through their eyes. And it's also told through the experts' lens of scientists and doctors, including myself, guys like Mark Bittman, journalist, Michael Pollan, David Ludwig, Robert Lustig, and David Kessler, really leading thinkers in the food movement who call out the problem with the food industry. So that's the other myth that they're sort of blowing up here, is that all calories are the same, that it's really a matter of energy balance, that it's just about calories in, calories out. If you just eat less and exercise more, everything's fine. That 100 calories of sugar and M&Ms is the same as 100 calories of almonds. Almost every physician, every nutritionist, every government agency, the food industry, all of them promote that thinking, which is fundamentally flawed. And when you eat certain foods, they're biologically addictive. Sugar is 8 times as addictive as cocaine. They put animals on, for people who like animals, it's not a great study, but they put them on this electric shock pad and they have them eat sugar and they keep eating the sugar even while they're getting electric shock. It's that powerful of an addiction. So it sort of blows up the idea of willpower and personal responsibility. It really talks about how the food industry has deliberately created foods that are biologically addictive. They hire craving experts to create the bliss point of food, to create heavy users and get more stomach share. Those are their terms. Those are the actually insider terminology. That was from Michael Moss's book, Salt, Sugar, and Fat. And the movie then goes on to lay out the history of the food industry and talk about the ways in which they're very much like big tobacco. They're hiding this knowledge. They're deliberately, quote, spiking their foods with addictive ingredients that are driving this epidemic and holding them accountable. And they even challenge a lot of the things that Michelle Obama was doing, where she got co-opted by the food industry. They always try to insert themselves into the process in a way that seems good but is actually bad. For example, they said, well, you know, we're going to partner with Michelle Obama on the Let's Move campaign. We're going to get a trillion and a half calories out of the food supply. Isn't that a great thing to get kids healthier? Well, what does that mean? It means taking 10 calories out of an Oreo cookie so it's 90 calories instead of 100 calories, or a few calories out of a Pop-Tart. That doesn't make it better. If it's junk, if you make it a little less junkier, it's still junk. So this is really, you know, what the movie's trying to do is not only just bring awareness to these issues and call out the food industry and call out the addictive nature of food, call out sugar as one of the major drivers of disease, and call out the fact that these kids are suffering like we've never seen before in history and what the impact is that on the future of our country and the world. But it's also designed to create a set of tools for people to actually solve this problem, to activate communities. And I'm going to speak, and I've already gone and met with leading black pastors in Atlanta, for example, and we're putting together a coalition of community leaders and education leaders, pastors, who are willing to actually take this into their congregations, into their communities, into their schools, and begin to activate them to do something about it. And the first thing that we're encouraging them to do is what we call the Fed Up Challenge, which is everybody do a 30-day or a 10-day sugar detox. And it really provides a wonderful sort of leverage point in society for changing the conversation, for waking people up, for beginning to get people aware of what's really happening. So I'm very excited about this.
It does sound very exciting. You mentioned Michelle Obama. She has, of course, named her campaign to fight childhood obesity, Let's Move.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that name was probably created partially to appease the food industry because it implies that more exercise is the answer, and that's no doubt part of the problem, but it points away from the food that we and our children are eating. What would you like to see Michelle Obama do? If she didn't have a hand tied behind her back by having to appease, in some sense, the food industry, what would you like to see her do?
Well, I've actually seen her change a little bit in the second term, where we recently seen new programs to end food marketing schools. We've seen programs of changing food labeling to make it more intelligent, to put added sugar on the label, to put the actual serving of the package. You know, it says 2.5 servings on a 20-ounce bottle of soda. Most people don't share that. They drink the whole thing. So it says, you know, 100 calories or 200 calories. Well, it's actually maybe 500 calories. So they're trying to create more awareness. And I think that's a step in the right direction. But if I were her, if I had the power, the magic wand to change what's happening in this country, I would do what Mexico's doing, which is they actually experienced a dramatic rise in obesity and diabetes over the last couple of decades. And they saw it was connected to the increase in soda consumption and sugar. About 20% of their calories in this Mexican diet comes from soda. So what they've done is looked around the world at the initiatives that on a policy level would make a difference in changing food policy. And they left out one, which is changing food subsidies, which is really a problem in this country. But they got most of the others, which is number one, ending all food marketing of junk food on television and any media, and particularly to kids. Number two, eliminating all food that isn't health promoting from all schools. And in all public institutions, we should be able to do that. So there's no sugar, no processed food, no crap in schools. Three, they've changed food labeling to make it intelligent, not like we're doing, which is an incremental step, but a dramatic step where you say, okay, this is, you know, like a stoplight. This is green, yellow, red. You know, green, go for it. Yellow, caution. Red, this is going to cause problems. You know, eat with caution. And we can really dumb it down, make it simple for people so they understand. They also create a sugar tax. Now, there's controversy about that, but they create a tax on sugar. So they've created a number of initiatives that, from a policy point of view, will work together to make a difference. And I think that's something that we can begin to think about and look globally at the kinds of innovations that are happening that will change things. In the movie, they talked about, for example, how the World Health Organization wanted to take the guidelines for sugar down to 10%. Now, there's no minimum daily requirement of sugar for humans, right? It's like not like you have to have your 5 teaspoons of sugar or 10 teaspoons of sugar a day. But they said, look, we shouldn't be having more than 10%. Well, the Bush administration went after the WHO and they flew Tommy Thompson, the head of the Health and Human Services there, and they said, if you write up this recommendation, we will withhold our $400+ million of funding for the World Health Organization. They literally bribe them or coerce them through financial means to actually not change their policy. That's the level we're working at in terms of changing policy in this country. But if we had the courage, the political courage to do those things, I think it would make a difference. And that's why I think the movie and things like that are important, because they kind of bring awareness and they'll start to create change. And, you know, we see movements, they don't really start in Congress, they sort of end in Congress, you know, whether it's civil rights or abolition. These things started on a grassroots movement, and then they begin to spread into where policymakers just can't fight anymore, like gay marriage, for example. You know, it flips, and I think we're close to that flipping point.
When you just now described former President Bush sending Secretary Thompson to basically force this policy not from being enacted, it reminds me of something Michael Pollan said, which is that our government subsidizes obesity. While Mexico, as you've mentioned, is initiating policies to fight obesity, fight childhood obesity, and make healthier food available to more people. And in the process, by the way, they're using the funds generated by the sugar tax to provide clean, purified, safe water in all the schools in the country. I mean, these are really positive steps. But our government doesn't seem able or isn't sufficiently motivated to take those kinds of steps.
No, they're not. And I think it's really money and politics. I wrote a blog a few years ago during the last election about money, politics, and healthcare, and how money and politics is driving obesity and disease. Everything from how we create food policy, agricultural policies, to how we reimburse healthcare. I mean, if we actually paid for teaching kitchens, and we paid for cooking classes, and we paid for a whole different way of treating chronic illness, we would change the practice of medicine. We'd change the way people are doing things. And so what's so critical to me is actually finding a way to begin to shift this conversation and get people moving in their own communities. That's why I believe we need to decentralize our approach. We can't wait for government or corporations or industry to change. We have to start where we live. And I think health really happens where we live, in our kitchens, in our homes, in our workplaces, our communities, you know, our schools, and our faith-based communities. I always say it happens where we live, eat, play, pray, learn, and work. You know, that's where health really happens. And so that's why I've gone to places like churches, or I'm working in schools, or I'm working in, you know, activating people in social networks online, because that's where we can see the change. And then I think it'll snowball.
You mentioned earlier that industry hires craveability experts and seeks to create craveability as a quality in the food-like substances that they market. Obviously, if you can hook people on foods that they crave, then that's going to enhance your market share. But you've written that our hormones, our taste buds, even our brain chemistry have been hijacked by the food industry, which is a very powerful statement. Do you mean this at all metaphorically, or are you actually speaking biologically?
No, I'm a doctor, a scientist, and I'm sitting in my office in Lenox, Massachusetts, and I'm seeing patients, and I have really looked at the literature on this, and I've looked at deep into the biochemistry and hormones and brain chemistry of my patients, and I see exactly what's happening and how people cannot control their behavior, how literally your taste buds and your hormones and your neurotransmitters and your biochemistry, your genes, and your metabolism all have been co-opted and hijacked by the foods we're eating, so that people can't really control their behavior. And they're in a dysregulated state, so they feel lousy. I call it FLC syndrome, which is when you feel like crap, you know. And I think a lot of people walk around not recognizing how food is connected to how they feel. And I'm not referring to this, you know, metaphorically. This is a literal physiologic process. And I think a lot of people think about food addiction as an emotional issue, you know, you're a binge eater. And what we're learning is that this is a psychobiological issue. This is a complex issue. But for many people, when they do a 10-day detox, they actually get to experience for the first time what it feels like to own their bodies again. It's like they've been taken over by gremlins, and like you can get it back in just a few days by shifting what you're eating and by doing a few simple lifestyle practices that help reset your stress response, balance your hormones and brain chemistry, and it's extraordinary. And so I can talk about this all day long until I'm blue in the face, but what I really care about is people trying it so they actually can experience themselves how close they are to health and happiness. The body has this amazing natural intelligence, the capacity to reset very quickly. It doesn't take years or months. It can happen literally in days. And when people feel that, they go, oh my God, and I didn't have to suffer this way. I don't have to be subject to these cravings forever. I don't have to actually be controlled by urges and suffering from symptoms that I've thought were just something I was going to have to live with forever. I can change my life, and I can do it quickly. 10 days seems kind of a goofy program, but the reason I did it was I see that in my patients, and I see how powerful and quickly they can change by doing a dramatic enough shift. And I know you've written a lot about this and seen this, too.
I have, and it's marvelous when people own their body, as the phrase you used. They reclaim their taste buds. They reclaim their mouths and tongues. They reclaim their sense of vitality and vibrancy in their body and their resilience and the resourcefulness and their creativity and their joy in life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a marvelous thing to see, and I understand your excitement.
It's actually true. Imagine if we had a nation of happy, healthy, energetic, focused, loving, alert people. What happened? then, you know, it would be remarkable.
I would like to see that, but I think there are people in the food industry who would not want to see that. And they're profiting, really, from alienating us from our experience of ourselves, our power, and our health. And of late, I've seen, I'm sure you have too, a lot of what I call nutritional facades or health halos on products.
Mm-hmm.
The foods that are sold aren't really healthy, but they're promoted as such. Vitamin water, it sounds great, but it's really just sugar water with a few pennies of synthetic vitamins and maybe some natural flavors added. I've seen breakfast cereals that are marketed as whole grain, which of course sounds good, but 50% of the calories in them comes from added high fructose corn syrup or other refined sugars. I've seen yogurts that contain more sugar than ice cream. These health claims on food make us think these foods are good for us.
Yeah.
But I've seen so much of this that is fake, really, that I've actually come to think that it's generally a good idea to avoid foods with these kinds of claims. Do you see it at all that way?
Oh, my God, yes. I've written about this. My basic rule is, one of the rules for eating is, if it has a health claim on the label, it's probably bad for you. Right? If it says, you know, whole grain or low fat or low this or high that, you know, it's pretty scary. You know, for example, I have this video I did when I was working with the Daniel Plan. It was really funny. We went through a supermarket, and I was like, how do you survive the American food desert? How do you hunt and gather in one of the most dangerous places in America, which is the American supermarket? And we went through the aisles, and, you know, we pulled out stuff, and we'd read the labels and look at it. And one of the things we pulled out was this box of Quaker oats, and said, you know, healthy oat fiber lowers cholesterol. You know, this thing you'd be like just doing the best thing you can for your heart. Five different kinds of sugar after the oats with the next five ingredients. And you know, people have no idea what they're doing. As part of this movie, I went to South Carolina and worked with a family there. And it's pretty stunning to see their story. And they just didn't know. And I actually changed my thinking quite a bit, because I think a lot of us, including me, who, I mean, I've been in this field for a long time, had a latent judgment of people. I thought you should know. Everybody knows that soda's bad for you. Everybody knows that processed food is bad for you. But, like, people don't know. People really don't know. And this family was desperately trying to get healthy. The mother was probably 100 pounds overweight. The father was on dialysis and was 42 years old and could not lose the weight he needed to lose to get a new kidney. The son was pre-diabetic, almost diabetic at 15 years old, massively overweight. And they were having Diet Mountain Dew and peanut butter they thought was healthy, but it was full of trans fats and high fructose corn syrup. They were having Cool Whip because they thought it said zero trans fats on the label, but all it was high fructose corn syrup and trans fats. Trans fat was the second ingredient after water. And they were eating things that they thought were healthy salad dressings, and it was all junk, and they were so sick from it. And I just took everything out of the cupboard. We looked at everything. I explained it to them in a very simple way, and I gave them my cookbook, and I gave them a guide from the Environmental Working Group called Good Food on a Tight Budget, which is about how to eat food that's good for you, good for the planet, and good for your wallet. And they did it. They spent $1,000 a month on food for the family of five. They were on disability and food stamps. And with a little bit of the right information, they stopped buying the junk and eating it, got eating real food, realized that food was actually delicious. They were so surprised when we actually cooked a meal together, and it tasted good. And the mother lost 100 pounds, the father lost 45 pounds, got a new kidney a few months ago. The son's lost 40 pounds, but then he gained a little bit back because he went to McDonald's to go get a job, because there was nowhere else to get a job in Easley, South Carolina. There's actually one of the worst ratios that we call the Retail Food Environment Index, which is the ratio of fast food and convenience stores to grocery stores or produce markets. It's like 10 to 1. It's one of the worst food deserts in America. So if they could do it there, anybody can do it. But they didn't really have the right information. I think it's really, really important that we get people access to the right information, and people will change.
Sometimes people are misled or believe things that aren't helpful or true. I don't know if this family that you were referring to would fall into this category, but a lot of people believe today that genetics rules, that the best thing you can do if you want to live a long and healthy life is to choose your parents very carefully.
Yeah. No. No, it's true, John. That's what people believe. I won or lost the genetic lottery, right? You know, my grandmother had diabetes, my mother's overweight. There's nothing I can do. And we inherit tendencies from our parents, but we don't inherit destiny. When we look at the data, it's quite striking. You're more likely to be overweight if your friends are overweight than if your parents or siblings are overweight. That the social threads and the the connections we have are more important than the genetic threads, and that, you know, health is contagious, but so is disease and obesity, right? So the more we understand that, that it's really about the social environment we live in that's driving it, not the genetics, that makes a difference. You know, the Pima Indians, for example, in Arizona, they're massively overweight, the second most obese population, 80% are diabetic by the time they're 30. Their cousins in Mexico live the traditional lifestyle and diet. They're all thin and pretty fit and don't have much diabetes or obesity. Same genes, different environment.
When you say, and I hadn't heard this before, that you're more likely to be overweight if your friends are overweight than you are if your parents are overweight.
Yeah.
That's a startling information. And it makes me wonder, if you have friends that are overweight, you don't want to dissociate from people that you love because they have health problems. But at the same time, they don't want to feel criticized if you harp on them to change. How do you respond to people that you love that are in your close circle who aren't eating healthily and maybe being a bad influence on you, and you want to be a good influence on them, but how do you handle that?
Well, you know, what's interesting, at the church, we had the experience where, I mean, the average weight for men was 210 and for women was 170. That's like average. And their culture was all about eating, you know, pancake breakfast, ice cream socials, comfort donuts and coffee, and join the church, and soda everywhere. And so what we did was we realized that if people banded together, if they helped each other, if used the power of positive peer pressure, it actually works very well. So, yeah, you can dump your friends who are overweight, but you could also connect with them and say, hey, you know, I'm doing this. Why don't you do it with me? Or let's get a group of us together and do it. And that's really why I encourage people to do this together. We have Facebook communities where people do it together and they support each other. And it really works. The people who did this together lost twice as much weight as people who did it alone. So I think, you know, yeah, you want to pick skinny friends. That would help. But I think if you really look at how to change, it's really by using the power of love. I call it the love diet. You know, how do we love each other well? How do we connect for success? How do we really use the power of each other to help us heal? And that's what I think the future is here.
That's a beautiful thought. I appreciate that, Mark, very much. I want to ask you about something else. There is another belief that prevails in our society, and I think it's there as strong as it is, partially because the dairy industry likes to tell us the milk is nature's most perfect food. And I've always thought, well, yes, that's true if you happen to be a baby calf, an animal that has four stomachs and will gain about 300 pounds during its first year.
Yeah.
But many people believe this, and also they feel compelled, they feel obligated, that it's healthy for them to consume a lot of dairy products, and this can include ice cream and high-fat, high-salt cheeses, and yet they think they're doing a good thing for their health by doing so.
Absolutely. I mean, I just had two people in my office today who graduated from Ivy League schools, you know, highly intelligent, very well-educated, very brilliant people, and they're telling me they're giving their kid three glasses of milk a day, that they're drinking milk because they think it's healthy for them. How are they going to keep their bones strong? How are their kids going to grow? How do they get their calcium? It was actually in your book that I actually first understood this, and I realized that it wasn't about the calcium in milk. It's really about all the other stuff we're doing to cause our bodies to lose calcium, and that there are much better sources of calcium. And in fact, my friend David Ludwig and Walter Willett from Harvard recently wrote a powerful study, an editorial, in JAMA Pediatrics, which I wrote about in a blog called Got Proof, Lack of Evidence for Milk's Benefits. And they go through the lack of evidence for all the things that we actually believe are true about milk, like it's good for your bones, or you need it to grow strong, or, you know, it's good for you. In fact, they found that it causes more heart disease risk. It causes cancer. It causes osteoporosis. You're more likely to break your bones if you drink milk than not, that it actually makes you gain weight, that milk's got 60 hormones that all are anabolic, that drive the building of tissue, including fat. And so, yeah, if you want to build a cow, okay, use milk, but not a human. I think it's done a disservice to our nation by having the USDA be the determinant of food policy. The Agriculture Department and the government should not be developing food guidelines for consumption. They support agricultural interests, and there's tremendous amounts of lobbying and influence that's driving their food recommendations that have nothing to do with science. I remember meeting with Senator Harkin in Washington. We're working on health policy, and I said, Senator Harkin, all we're trying to do is have the science become policy. And he looked at me, kind of smiled, shook his head, and he says, gee, that would make too much sense. And David, look, my friend was on the phone with policymakers and other scientists on these committees to talk about food policy and guidelines. And he said, you know, there really isn't any evidence for dairy here that we're recommending 3 glasses for the average adult and 2 for the average kid. And they were like, yeah, well, we kind of know, but, you know, like, we kind of can't take that recommendation out. And I'm like, well, what's really going on here? I mean, who's running the show? And it's clearly not a government for the people, by the people, of the people. It's government for the corporations, by the corporations, and increasingly of the corporations. My friend Bobby Kennedy said that what's happened is that capitalism has defeated communism, but then capitalism is now subverting democracy. And he says we have what we call a corporate kleptocracy. In communism, the government runs business. In capitalism, business runs government. And I think that's what's happening, and it's frightening. But we can do something about it, and I think that's why your work and the food revolution and the summit and initiatives like this, more and more of this conversation has to happen, and movies like Fed Up and your books, my books, others who are in this field who are writing about this, we all are together on the same journey and really calling out what's really happening in a way to get people to wake up and pay attention. And it's all connected. You know, I think what people don't realize is that what you put on your fork is connected to every single thing that's happening around you. It's driving what happens to our economy because of healthcare costs. It's driving what happens to our environment because of soil degradation, the depletion of our aquifers and loss of water. Wars of the future are going to be fought over water because we're irrigating using 5% of the Earth's fresh water. 70% of that is used to, you know, irrigate land for growing crops for animals, for human consumption. We're depleting our soils. We're losing an acre of arable land every minute to desertification because of how we're practicing agriculture. We're destroying a huge swath of ocean through these dead zones that come from using the nitrate and organophosphate pesticides and fertilizers that are getting into the rivers and destroying our oceans. And it just goes on and on and on. So not only are we creating environmental degradation, we're depleting nature's capital, human capital, we're also creating political instability, economic instability, and it all comes down to what you put on your fork. And that's why we need a food revolution. So I love what you're doing, John. I think this is so powerful, so important, and I'm behind you 100%.
Well, thank you, Mark, and your contributions are extraordinary. They're absolutely among the most important ones today, and I'm very grateful to you. We all are, for what you're doing. I want to ask you about one more thing. You were talking about how corporate interests can control government. They control governmental policies. They actually also, of course, control a lot of what we eat, and they do that by controlling what we think. They control our minds. They do that through advertising. They do that through actually a lot of more subtle and insidious ways besides overt advertising. But one of the things that they get us to think and believe is that there are no good foods or bad foods, that all calories are created equal.
Uh-huh.
They tell us that all we need to do is we need more willpower, that we need to eat less and exercise more and everything would be fine. And I think there's some cruelty in that. I think there is, in telling people that their problems are due to a lack of willpower, some kind of character defect, there's something that is being obfuscated there and redirected or misdirected. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Absolutely. You know, I think this is what led me to write the 10-Day Detox Diet. You know, I wrote the Blood Sugar Solution about addressing the epidemic of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes and giving people a plan. But then I realized that there was another layer going on here. As I began to look at the research, and, you know, since I wrote that first book, there was a textbook that came out that was edited by Kelly Brownell, formerly from the Yale Center for Food Policy and Obesity. He's now Dean of Public Health at Duke, and it was called Food and Addiction. And I began to review the research and review the literature and begin to look at both human and animal studies. And I looked at, for example, David Ludwig's study where he gave people trick milkshakes. And this is really a powerful study that sort of blows up the whole idea of calories. And there's many more. He basically took a bunch of overweight guys. He gave them milkshakes, 2 different milkshakes, but they were designed to be almost exactly the same in every way except for how much they raise your blood sugar. So they have the same taste, the same calories, the same grams of protein, grams of fat, grams of carbs. Everything was the same except one had a starch in it that raised the blood sugar quickly and one didn't. And when they followed these guys and looked at their blood work and their brain scans, they found that on the blood work, the high sugar milkshake spiked insulin, it spiked their blood sugar, and they were craving a lot of sugar and carbs shortly after they drank this milkshake. And when they look at their brains, they lit up on a functional MRI like a Christmas tree in the area that's ground zero for addiction called the nucleus accumbens. And that's the area that gets lit up with cocaine or heroin or many of the addictive substances that are really have potential for abuse. And what that study showed me was that this is a real biological problem. This is not simply all calories are the same. And when we look at how, for example, when you use sugar calories versus more good quality fat and protein, you actually will cause the body to accumulate more fat and lose muscle, even on identical calorie diets. You will speed up metabolism by eating less sugar than when you eat more sugar, even on exactly the same calorie diet. So once we sort of understand that this is a big lie, and there are so many food lies, John, you've written so much about them, but if we blow up this lie that all calories are the same, then all of a sudden we go, yes, there are good and bad foods. There, it's not just about calorie balance or energy balance. It's not just about eating less and exercising more. It's about eating the wrong foods and not eating the right foods. In the movie, it was stunning. You know, the guy's like, you know, we're supposed to drink 2 liters of liquids a day, and Coca-Cola can be a good source of those liquids for the average person. I fell over in my chair. That kind of thinking is not only flawed, but it's dangerous. And that's unfortunately what our own government is promoting. And I think we need more voices to shout this out from the treetops and the rooftops and tops of skyscrapers and billboards everywhere. And this movie that up does a great job of doing this. I encourage everybody who's listening to go out and watch this movie, bring a friend, bring 10, and, you know, start a conversation about this in your own communities, because it's really how we're going to begin to change this.
When you said that eating the high sugar, high fat food generated signals in the brain that were essentially identical to those produced by cocaine, I thought, well, does this mean that the industrial food system is the biggest drug dealer of all?
Absolutely. I think, you know, when we look at it in terms of volume, it just pales in comparison to every other substance of abuse. Alcohol, I mean, the impact of alcohol is significant, tobacco is significant, but it's a fraction of the impact of eating these foods are around the globe. I mean, now we have 80% of the world's diabetics in the developing world. We have, you know, China and India are number 1 and 2. This is not just an American problem anymore, and they're pushing these substances. We've created the worst diet on the planet, and we're exporting it to every nation in the world and killing them. In the movie, there was a great line by Harvey Karp. He says, if a foreign nation was doing to our children what we're doing to them, we would go to war over how the harm is being created in our children. I mean, that sort of stuck with me because it's true. If we had a foreign nation poisoning our kids, getting them addicted, creating obesity and diabetes in kids, we would go to war.
And instead we subsidize it.
Yes, we are right there in line promoting it all.
Well, Mark, your leadership is one of the bright lights in our world today. You're helping millions of people to reclaim their taste buds and their health and their sanity, frankly, and take back control of their lives from corporate interests and from food companies that do not have any of our best interests in mind. It's always a really great pleasure to talk with you and to see the growing influence your work is having on the lives of an ever-increasing number of people.
Well, I'm not going to stop till I have my last breath, because I just see how close we are. And I think if people can have the experience and we can provide them with tools and strategies to change, then we can really make a huge, huge difference.
Well, you are, and we're grateful to be allies with you in this endeavor. And I want to thank you again for being with us today. And thank you even more so for the incredibly important work you're doing every day.
Thanks, John. Thanks, Ocean. I really appreciate this opportunity to talk to people and talk to you and just have some fun.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Mark Hyman, the author of 8 number 1 New York Times bestsellers, including The Blood Sugar Solution 10-Day Detox Diet. Mark, you combine brilliant, scientifically grounded insights with passion, eloquence, and love. Your love for humanity, your love for health, your passion about thriving is utterly contagious. So thank you for being the light that you are in this world, for changing the lives of millions of people, and for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you so much, Ocean. I appreciate that.
This concludes our interview, but our work is just getting started. If you feel excited by what you just heard and want to share it with other people in your life, if you want permanent access to 23 more amazing presentations and transcripts, then we have an offer to share. You can get a download and a transcript of the entire Food Revolution Summit, plus a huge collection of bonus resources. If you like, you can also get CDs, members-only courses, and a lot more. This empowerment package is available for a major discount between now and the end of the summit. For more information, please visit foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Again, that's foodrevolution.org/empowerment. Thanks so much for joining us in the Food Revolution. To express your opinions on what you've been hearing and to find out what other people are saying, post and engage in the comments section at the bottom of our broadcasts page. You'll need to refresh the page in order to see the latest comments from other summit participants. For our next presentation, we'll be on the line via teleconference with health pioneer and five-time New York Times best-selling author, Dr. Dean Ornish. We'll start that at the top of the hour and follow it at the top of the next hour in a teleconference interview with Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Until then, this is some music from our friend, Bruce Beckvar. Thank you.